Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm Assistant Secretary, Research Branch. Welcome to the Parliamentary Library for the annual Parliamentary Library Understanding the Budget Seminar. Of course, we can't tell you anything you don't already know about tonight's budget, but we can hope to help you find your way around the budget papers and give you a bit of a sense of what the overall financial situation is like. So we have two speakers this morning. Robert Dollamore will speak first and give some thoughts on the context of the 2015-16 budget. And then Daniel Waite will speak on an overview of the budget papers and how to find information in the portfolio budget statements, given there's quite a lot of them as usual. Each speaker will speak for about 20 minutes and then we'll have time for questions at the end. So without further ado, I shall hand over to Robert.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming along today. Before Dan presents on the budget papers, I'm just going to briefly provide some of the context for this year's budget, covering the global outlook, the domestic outlook, the other economic policy levers. And finally, I'm going to leave you with a series of questions which are really just intended to try and help you form your own view about this year's budget. There's a lot of information out there about the global economic context, but I'm just going to quickly touch on two. The IMF's latest growth forecasts. They're pretty much ballpark with the other international economic forecasters such as the OECD. And Brookings, in collaboration with the Financial Times, released their latest update of the tracking indexes for the global economic recovery last month as well, which are also worth a quick look. So starting with the IMF's growth forecasts, we can see that in recent years growth has been around 3.4%. That's a bit below the long-term average of 3.7%. In 2015, the IMF forecast suggests that growth will be pretty much unchanged at around 3.5%. But of course, there's a lot going on underneath these numbers. In the immediate period after the global financial crisis, a lot of the growth momentum came from emerging market and developing economies, whereas many of the advanced economies were stuck in low gear. More recently, there's been a slight rebalancing of growth, with advanced economies forecast to grow a little stronger this year at 2.4%, up from 1.8% last year, and emerging market and developing economies forecast to grow a little slower at 4.3%, down from 4.6% last year. The IMF emphasises that the factors that are shaping the global economic outlook are quite complex, including the decline in the price of oil, the fact that many countries are still struggling under a significant debt burden, and a stronger US dollar. This chart just looks at the IMF forecast for a range of countries Australia has a particular interest in, because of financial, trade and investment linkages. Over here we have Australia, so you can see in relative terms to some other advanced economies, Australia actually doesn't look too bad. If we take the United States to start with, the US got off to a slightly slower start this year, but it's largely one-off factors such as severe weather conditions and industrial disruptions along the West Coast ports. US growth is expected to pick back up over the course of this year. But I think what's interesting about the IMF forecast is that as we go out to 2020, the IMF is actually forecasting the US economy to slow again, reflecting their view that the potential US growth rate is now only around 2%. The US itself is facing some significant headwinds, an ageing population, and relatively, low or weaker productivity growth. If we look at China, the IMF's forecasting growth to slow through to about 2017. That reflects China's transition to more balanced growth and also some of the excesses in real estate investment and investment more generally beginning to unwind. But the good news is from the IMF that growth is expected to stabilise around 6%, so not a hard landing. The American think tank Brookings, in conjunction with the Financial Times, has been putting together their tracking indexes for global economic recovery for some time. It's a great acronym, so I thought I'd give it a run. There's quite a bit of information in the Brookings report. I just want to focus on two of the indexes, overall growth and real activity. So we see very clearly the effect of the GFC. The sort of gold line is the emerging market economies, the blue line is the advanced economies. We can see a lot of that initial growth momentum immediately after the impact of the GFC came from those emerging market and developing economies. But as we look out, the growth momentum's been relatively subdued, and that's true of both the emerging market economies and the advanced economies. These two charts just take the final time period for both the previous charts, so run from January 2012 to January this year. So they allow us to see a little bit of what's been happening through to the beginning of this year. And what we see is a very clear slowdown in growth momentum and in terms of real activity amongst the emerging market and developing economies, and not a lot of sign of a pickup at that stage amongst the advanced economies. So what do we sort of take from the IMF and the Tiger forecast? It's really just that growth's been fairly moderate in recent years. It still looks like it's going to be fairly moderate in the near term. Growth's also been relatively uneven across the world. And the authors of both sets of updates have really urged governments around the world to take decisive policy action to lift actual and potential growth. So to not just rely on easy monetary policy and exchange rate depreciations, but to pursue the sort of structural reforms that will build growth for the future. As always, the global outlook is subject to a number of risks. These include the price of oil, which is potentially both an upside and a downside risk. On the upside, it may be the case that the fall in the price of oil has a more stimulatory effect on the advanced economies than currently forecast. Alternatively, if the price of oil rises faster than currently forecast, it would have a dampening effect on growth. This year, the US Federal Reserve is expected to raise the official interest rate, probably in the second half of this year. When that happens, we'll see a divergence between the policy settings of the major central banks. That follows a period when the policy settings of the major central banks have been pretty much in sync, and it also follows a period when the major central banks have been resorting to some unconventional policy tools. We still don't really know how that's going to play out. It may go very smoothly, but there may also be a few bumps along the way as people get used to the new financial landscape. Emerging market economies potentially face a double whammy. A higher US dollar, there's been quite a lot of borrowing by those economies in US dollars, and as the US dollar appreciates, their debt burden increases. It's also possible the higher global interest rates and more volatile capital flows. It's possible we could see a sharper than expected slowdown in China, particularly if investment is weaker than currently forecast. And there's a range of geopolitical risks on the horizon as well, thinking about Greece, the Ukraine, some parts of Africa and the Middle East. And a topic that's been getting quite a bit of coverage in the economics literature is just whether we've actually entered a period of protracted slower growth. Turning to the Australian economy, there's undoubtedly some positives. We've had a very long period of unbroken economic growth, and I think, more than 6 years after the global financial crisis and has given us a perspective on the sort of damage a severe financial recession can cause in other advanced economies. We also have low inflation and rising but relatively low levels of government debt. Growth in the last couple of years has been below the long-term average of around 3.2%, and that's expected to be the case again this year. Weighing on growth, we've had a very significant decline in the terms of trade as commodity prices have fallen. We've got declining mining investment, the speed of which seems to be picking up, and we've had subdued business and consumer confidence for most of the year. Supporting growth, we've had a significant increase in the volume of resources exports. We've seen a pickup in housing investment, some recovery in household consumption. The lower Australian dollar over the course of the year is, of course, helping trade-exposed industries. But we still face the challenge of making the transition as we move from the investment phase of the mining boom through to the production to more balanced growth. Just looking at the IMF's growth forecast for Australia, we see that growth has been relatively subdued in recent years. If you take just a simple average from 2008, gross average of 2.5%. The IMF's forecasting growth for Australia to come in at 2.8% and not to get back to the long-term average until 2016. Interestingly, the IMF has this trailing off of growth for Australia as we head out to 2020, and I think that's really an acknowledgement by the IMF that their view is we do face some significant headwinds, including an ageing population, and that Australia will have to work a little bit harder if we're going to get growth back to the long-term average or better. One way of seeing just how the outlook has changed over the last 12 months, these are the Reserve Bank of Australia's forecasts from the Statement of Monetary Policy. And we can see that across the year, the RBA has revised down the growth outlook on a number of occasions, including last week. So in February, we had a revision, a downward revision to the growth forecast for this calendar year, but the RBA had left unchanged the growth forecast for 2016. Last week, we saw the RBA downgrade their growth forecast across the board. There's also, of course, a number of risks for the Australian domestic economy, and these are potentially risks also for the budget. It's possible we could see a faster and larger fall in mining investment than currently forecast. Commodity prices could fall more than currently forecast. It could be that the exchange rate really takes longer to reach the level needed for structural adjustment. Governor Stevens has nominated a dollar of about 75 US cents, and we're still consistently above that. The recovery in household expenditure may not be sustained. On the one hand, increasing house prices means that households are wealthier, certainly in some areas, but wages growth is very subdued. The unemployment outlook is that unemployment is expected to continue to increase for a while longer, so it remains to be seen whether households will actually save less and spend more. And finally, the recovery in non-mining investment, which is so important to Australia's transition to more balanced growth, could take longer than expected. With the short-term outlook so complex, both globally and domestically, it's easy to lose sight of some of the things that are on the longer-term horizon, but on Budget Day, it's important to keep these in mind. You would probably, everyone will have a different list of these things, but mine would include an ageing population, climate change, natural resource depletion, the economic rise of Asia, which is a significant opportunity, changing global demand, and new knowledge and technologies. It's also important on Budget Day to remember that while the budget is clearly very important, it's not the only policy lever. Monetary policy, which is the responsibility of the Reserve Bank, has been very accommodative for a long time now. We've had very low interest rates, which is supporting Australia's transition to more balanced growth. In terms of the exchange rate policy, since December 83, we've had a floating exchange rate, so the value of the Australian dollar is determined by market forces. So it's certainly, the budget's very important for the government in terms of being able to influence the macro environment. But it's also worth remembering microeconomic reforms. These are typically intended to increase productivity and growth in the longer term by sharpening incentives, enhancing capabilities, and enhancing flexibility. Finally, I just want to finish by proposing a set of questions which are really just intended to help you think about the budget from some different perspectives. I certainly don't claim this is a definitive list, but these are things which you might want to think about over the days ahead. Okay, so if we start with the overall package, one question you might want to ask is, what problems is the budget actually trying to solve? And what does the budget actually deliver in terms of the public goods and services and the transfers that are funded through the budget, the investment? What is the government's fiscal strategy? Are there things in the budget that are going to support growth? Who wins and who loses? What's the overall effect on community well-being going to be? And how well does the budget actually reflect community preferences? Of course, the budget's more than just a set of numbers. It comes with a narrative, which is the chance for the government to actually explain why it's taking the decisions it's taken in terms of the economic outlook and its policy agenda. It's important to ask how well does the narrative align with Australia's current situation and outlook? If change is needed, does the narrative actually make a convincing case for change? How might it affect confidence, and is it likely to resonate with the broader community? In terms of the numbers, it's always worth looking at the underlying assumptions. Are they plausible? Do they sort of line up with what other economic commentators and analysts are saying? If there's a change in the bottom line, what's driving the change? It's important to have regard for what's happening in the out years, and for some very large measures, it might be the case that you want to think even beyond the out years. And is Australia's fiscal position sustainable? In terms of the measures, again, it's interesting to ask what's new and what's not. Sometimes things, programs get merged, things are rebadged. Something might look new, but actually not. That may not be the case. Are the budget measures consistent with the narrative that the government set out? And importantly, what's the quality of the individual measures? And some of the criteria you might want to use here are look at it from a growth perspective, objective, equity, sustainability, policy consistency, risks and opportunities, and whether any of the measures are a bit of a are innovative. Does the numbers attached to the new measures do they look plausible? And are the measures going to be a hard or easy sell? The risks, the budget actually sets out, the budget, as Dan will say, the budget paper set out what the government sees as the risk to the budget. You might want to think about the overall balance of risk and whether the budget's assessment of the risks actually aligns with what other commentators are saying. Finally, no matter how good any budget is, there's always a degree of unfinished business. No budget can do everything. So one question you might want to ask is if further fiscal adjustment is needed, how much still needs to be done? Looking at current trends in revenue and expenditure, you might want to ask whether any of them look unsustainable. And given the challenges Australia faces, are there likely future pressure points? That concludes my presentation, so I'll pass over to Dan.
Right. I'd just like to start by having a quick sort of recap of the current fiscal position of the Commonwealth. And this has obviously got a fair degree of media attention recently, but it's worth just recapping. These numbers are from the Mid-Year Economic and Fiscal Outlook document, which was released in December. So that's the latest budget update. So what the Treasury releases this evening will be an update upon that last position or that last set of numbers in the Mid-Year Economic and Fiscal Outlook. You can see here that Australia, or the Commonwealth, was in broadly a surplus, or broadly a balanced budget, I think is the best way of describing it, position from about 2001 through to about 2007 and 8. And then, because of the global financial crisis, we saw an uptick in payments and a fall-off in receipts. You can see that the trend is coming back together, and on the latest numbers, as per my IFO, we're forecast to essentially have reducing deficits into the future, but there is still sort of persistent deficits into the future. Another thing I think you should maybe take out of this chart is just the actual magnitude of how much money the Commonwealth actually spends and collects in taxation. Even in this deficit position, the Commonwealth still collects around $385 billion a year in revenue, and it's currently on the latest numbers, is currently spending about $420 billion. So whether or not the deficit or surplus is significant in the context of the total amounts being spent is, I suppose, a question you can consider. Just to unpick this a little bit, this is actually the real change in receipts and payments since 2000. Now, when I say real, that means adjusted for inflation. And you can see that in 2000, there was a reasonable spike in payments and also a reasonable spike in tax receipts. That's probably mostly attributable to the introduction of the GST and some of the compensation which was paid as part of that process. And then through up until probably the global financial crisis period, roughly expenditure increases and tax receipt increases were broadly in balance. Following on from the global financial crisis period, it's really a little bit difficult to discern a pattern, I really think. In the out years, the ones that are shaded here that are still only estimates, there is, on the latest numbers, projected to be greater revenue increases than there is expenditure increases. But all this will be updated this evening, so this is, I suppose, the starting position that we have on the best information that we have at the moment. Okay, I'd just like to take you through some of the key concepts that are used in the budget papers and the budget more generally. Okay, the Australian Constitution establishes a consolidated revenue fund. Now, this is a little bit like a bank account for the Commonwealth, and all money received by the Commonwealth in any of its capacities has to be placed into that consolidated revenue fund and may only be released after an appropriation by the Parliament. So that's where we that's really the central event that is occurring on Budget Night. It's the presentation of the appropriation bills, which will authorise the release of that money out of the Consolidated Revenue Fund. The Treasurer this evening will table at least three appropriation bills, Appropriation Bill number 1 and Appropriation Bill number 2. There is a very technical difference between these two bills, and it mostly relates to the powers at the Senate. This Odgers Senate practice has very good information about what the different powers of the Senate over the two different types of bills are. So if you need further information, I'd refer to that. And also a parliamentary, an appropriation parliamentary departments bill. This bill provides for Parliament, and it reflects that the Parliament is independent from the executive government. Now, whilst these annual appropriation bills are tabled, and then it's the proposal for additional expenditure in the 2015-16 year, actually a relatively small amount of money is actually provided each year through the annual appropriation bills. It's around 20%. Most of the Commonwealth Government's expenditure is provided through special appropriations. Now, these are appropriations which provide unlimited amounts of money, but in very narrow and confined circumstances. So under social security legislation, there is a standing appropriation or a special appropriation which provides unlimited amounts of money for anyone who's eligible for a particular social security payment. So in thinking about controlling expenditure, it's important, I think, to consider what's happening under these special appropriations under which the vast majority of the Commonwealth's expenditure is provided for. Somewhat unhelpfully, the Commonwealth uses somewhat of a unusual measure of its surplus or deficit position. Many jurisdictions, such as the states and territories, will use a measure called the fiscal balance, which is an accrual accounting measure that really matches money to when it's earned or when expenses are incurred. It largely disregards when cash actually arrives or is paid. The Commonwealth uses an underlying cash balance, which is a very similar measure, but it operates on a cash accounting basis. And most of the time when you hear about the Commonwealth talking about a surplus or deficit position, what most commentators are talking about is the underlying cash balance. If you go and compare this maybe to a state government budget paper, you may find a different set of terminology, the fiscal balance terminology. Also, some of the material in the budget papers is actually presented on a fiscal balance basis. So it's a little bit confusing, but it's just something I think the best advice is to just be aware of it. Okay. Now, some of the language in the budget papers refers to policies, decisions versus parameter variations, and we'll give you an example of what the differences are later in the presentation. But policy decisions are, as the name implies, the decisions of the government. They are things which are within the control of the government, so a new item of expenditure, deciding to change an eligibility for a program or changing the tax laws. These are things which the government can make a decision and implement, and it has a direct effect. Parameter variations are things which are basically outside the direct control of the government. For example, company tax revenues will be influenced by corporate profits. Personal income tax revenues will be influenced by the level of the total amount of employment in the economy. Payments of unemployment benefits will be influenced by the number of people who are unemployed. And Medicare claims will be influenced by the number of people who are eligible under that program and who essentially make a claim. That's a very difficult thing for the Commonwealth to control directly. You'll see that sometimes there's been some announcements in relation to pensions, I think is a very good example, where the government has suggested that because of the change in the profile of the expenditure, which would be reflected as a parameter variation, the government is indicated that it will make policy decisions to try and change that total amount of expenditure by changing the eligibility criteria. Okay. And another concept which is used throughout the budget papers is a distinction between administered and departmental. Now, administered is really anything which the Commonwealth, which a government department does on behalf of the Commonwealth and doesn't have any particular discretion or control over. For example, the payment of social security payments, health and education funding to universities or hospitals, and also revenue which comes into the Commonwealth that will be received by the Treasury Department. But the Treasury Department obviously can't simply take that money. It administers the transfer of that into the Consolidated Revenue Fund for the Commonwealth. When I say they have no control over it, obviously in relation to social security payments and things such as that, the department has the role of assessing whether or not someone's eligible, but it can't decide how much, you know, once someone is eligible, how much they're actually going to pay. Departmental items are really the things that you think of as, I suppose, the bureaucracy in Canberra. It's salaries for public servants, it's office supplies, it's rent on government office buildings. It's also some programs, more programs that are driven by sort of grants. So a scheme of grants to people who are doing certain work in a particular area might actually be a departmental item. When you think of things like the efficiency dividend, which is intended to reduce the size of the bureaucracy or reduce the cost of the bureaucracy, that's mostly affecting only departmental items. So that's just something to keep in mind. Okay, now we'll go on to the budget papers now, and I just want to focus on probably three of these a little bit more through the presentation, but I'll just run through most of them now. As I said, legally, technically, in parliamentary terms, the most important budget paper is the appropriation bills. This is a number two bill from 2014-15 budget. If you open them up, they're actually very technical, and to be honest, there's really not a huge amount of useful information in there. They are worth a look, but it's not where most of the useful information in the budget papers is. Now, each year, the government, in terms of presenting its budget, often releases things such as ministerial statements. They can take really any form. Here are some ministerial statements or just sort of policy statements which were released at the last budget. These really bring together information across portfolios on a particular theme or issue, and they are really a reasonably simplistic presentation of what the government, you know, wants to highlight in the budget papers. In prior years, there have been more substantial ministerial statements that have been printed, such as this. There's no obligation for the Commonwealth to print them, but in prior years there have been a lot more. There have been these what have been called blues on particular issues. There have reasonably consistently been ones on foreign aid and regional spending. So just look out for those. Okay. And the budget speech is a copy of the second reading speech which the Treasurer gives with the presentation of the appropriation bills. Okay, now we'll go on to the main budget papers. It's important, I think, to point out that the type of information, if you have a concept of the type of information that you are looking for, it will change where you probably should start looking. If you're really interested in the macroeconomic, the broad big picture, the effect of this budget on the Australian economy, probably budget paper number one, budget strategy and outlook, has most of the macroeconomic technical information. If you're interested in what's happening in individual portfolios or what the priorities for government spending is, you probably would be best looking in budget measures, and because that has all the new and new policies and changed policies of the Commonwealth. Federal Financial Relations has important information about the payments by the Commonwealth back to the states. And agency resourcing shows really the total amounts that are available to individual agencies. Okay, but we'll go through some examples. Okay. Now, budget paper one. Now, this can change a little bit in any given year, but this is a pattern which has been pretty consistent over the years. Budgets In budget paper number one, they have individual statements, and last year there were 10 of them. Really, the first four provide the economic and fiscal outlook for the Commonwealth, and also they provide the government an opportunity to really frame their thinking around the broader macro and fiscal environment. So that's really much, very much the government's sort of big narrative. Statement 5 deals with high-level information on revenues, so total amounts anticipated to be collected under certain heads of taxation or as user charges or something like that. Statement 6 deals with expenses, and it shows expenses by category of expenses, so how much is spent on welfare, how much is spent on education, and has forecasts into the future. Statement 7, I think Robert spoke a little bit about risks to the budget. Statement 7 has the identified risks that have been identified by the Commonwealth in preparing the budget. It has some of those are quantifiable, some of those are unquantifiable. But it's in, you know, under each portfolio there may be an identified risk which, if it crystallised, may have a particular impact. Also, there is a new requirement for there to be a debt statement, and this has, and that last year was in Statement 7, has quite very good information relative to what was there previously about the Commonwealth's Commonwealth securities, the amount of debt owed, to whom it's owed, and so forth. Okay, budget financial statements is really the accounting type stuff. It really is the financial statements of the Commonwealth as a whole. And Statement 10 is very good for making longer-term comparisons about, you know, what's changed over time. This is Australian historical government data. That has information that goes back to 1970 to 71 in some cases. So there's important information in there. Okay. This is just some examples of the information that's in budget paper number one. These estimates are obviously out of date because they're from last year's budget, but this is just the simple forecast for what the underlying cash balance of the Commonwealth will be and the fiscal balance of the Commonwealth. Okay. This is the government's, so therefore Treasury's, really, estimates of what's going to happen in the global economy and our major trading partners as at the 2014-15 budget. These are influential because macroeconomists are interested in what the Treasury Department and what the government as a whole actually thinks their trading partners are going to, how their trading partners are going to perform. Okay. And we spoke earlier about the difference between policy decisions and parameter variations. Here's a table that just shows a reconciliation of receipts, but it disaggregates out the effect of policy decisions relative to the effect of parameter variations. So you can see that generally through this table, parameter variations have a much bigger effect on revenues than are the policy decisions of the Commonwealth. But that's just an example of the type of information that's in BP1. Okay, budget paper number 2 is budget measures. Now, this has essentially the individual decisions of the government and their effect on the fiscal position of the Commonwealth. Here is an example from 2014-15 budget, and it's a reasonably simple example. It's a decision to spend less money on hosting the G20. And you can see that there's a simple explanation there. You can see a negative sign is basically $7 million reduction. That's reasonably a simple presentation of a reasonably simple budget measure. Unfortunately, they do get a little bit more complex. This is a decision to increase revenue, so the numbers are positive. And you can see that there is some money coming into the tax office, there is some money coming into the Australian Customs and Border Service, there's a total revenue line that adds up those. And because in implementing this policy decision, there's also a need to expend some money. There's also another line in here which actually has related expenditure, so expenditure which is related to the collection of the revenue. And unfortunately, measure descriptions do get a little bit more and more complex, even more complex than this. But all the information should be there. It's just sometimes quite difficult to interpret, unfortunately. Okay. Budget paper 3, I think, is probably the most underrated budget paper, if you can write budget papers. Each year, the Commonwealth spends about one quarter of its money providing grants to the states and territories. So last year, I think it was this current year, it's forecast to be $102 billion. Around half of that is the revenue from the GST, and that's obviously been a controversial issue about how that has been distributed amongst the various states and territories. But also the other half of it is payments for healthcare, payments for education, payments for disability services, infrastructure, and also road fund. I've got contingent funding here, sorry. That's money for things like national disaster relief and recovery arrangements. So if there is a disaster in Queensland, the Commonwealth will contribute money and you'll be able to identify the amount that is being flown through to the state of Queensland in that case. It would be remiss if you're interested in health policy, for example, and you simply went and looked at the health department and how much money they had. It would be a little remiss to ignore the quite significant amount of money that's also flowing through to the states to provide health services. So it's important not to forget about this budget paper number 3, which actually has some quite significant information in it about the overall spending of the Commonwealth. Okay, now portfolio budget statements. If you're interested in programs, what individual government departments are doing, the portfolio budget statements are really the most important source of information. It was suggested that I brought a lot to this presentation. Actually, I didn't bring a lot. There is one of these documents for every portfolio in the Commonwealth. Some of them are quite large, and had I brought them, they probably would have been stacked that high. Each individual portfolio will have a section for each individual agency within that portfolio. And for each individual agency, there will be an outcome that they are pursuing on behalf of the Commonwealth. There may be even more than one outcome, but there will be at least one outcome. And for each individual outcome, there will be individual programs that are contributing to that. Now, this is where some of the important information in the budget papers is disclosed. We'll give you one important piece of information which is shown in the portfolio budget statements is a total resource statement. So this is the total amount of resources that are available to a given government agency under all the different types of appropriations, including whether or not they're able to retain money they receive as user charges, that type of thing. So you can see this is the total resource or the resource statement for the Department of Communications, and it shows the total amounts that they're anticipated to have made available to them this is 2014-15. So if you're interested in what's happening in individual portfolios, where the government's priorities are, this is an important source of information. Okay. And this is the financial information for the Department of Communications in relation to Outcome 1. Now, Outcome 1 is promote an innovative and cooperative communications sector through policy development, advice, program delivery, so all Australians can realise the full potential of digital technologies and communication services. Now, that's a little bit aspirational, but if you actually look into the programs that are being delivered and which are being used to contribute to this outcome, you'll actually find that sometimes it's quite tangible and clear what is being delivered, how much. There are also things such as performance indicators, targets for delivery. And also here you can see that there is information about the total funding available. It's compared to the total funding that was made available in the prior year. So if you're interested in what's happening in a particular program or what a department's prioritising its expenditure on, this is probably the best place to look. Okay.
Just very quickly, just while that's fresh in my mind, the budget paper 2,
yes,
and what you just talked about then, the portfolio budget statement,
yes,
are those two linked? I mean, or are they related to each other? Should we be able to pick up?
Yes.
Between one and the other?
In the portfolio budget statement, there will be a reconciliation of the effect of budget measures on an agency which is affected. So they will separate out individually how a budget measure will affect that agency.
So the budget page of 2 is like just a summary of individual budget portfolio budget statements.
No, it's solely the individual decisions that the Commonwealth has made. The portfolio budget statement contains all the funding, all the financial statements, all the prior years, or the cumulative effect of all the prior years' decisions, and there is a reconciliation in there which will show the effect of the individual decisions made this year on an individual agency in the portfolio.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
Yes, can a copy of the budget itself for this year be made available after tonight?
Yes. The government, when the Treasurer starts his speech at 7:30 at www.budget.gov.au, all the papers will be made available in electronic form there. Also, I think members and senators will receive a hard copy as a matter of course, but they will be made available electronically at 7:30. In relation to budget portfolio budget statements, the production process is a little bit different. These are actually produced by the individual departments according to a template provided by Treasury and Finance, not by Treasury and Finance. These are largely made available at that 7:30 time, and there is a link through on the budget website to the individual departments' websites. But sometimes there's a slight delay, but basically these should be available on each individual portfolio's budget portfolio's website at 7:30. So, yes.
But it looks like there aren't any more questions, so at this point I'll wrap up proceedings. Just before we go, I'll just mention a couple of things. There's the budget review papers. Once the papers are released, the budget papers are released this evening, the library will be producing its usual series of budget review articles, which will be progressively released on the internet, on our website over the course of the week. You'll see the small flyers for these which are scattered around. The observant among you will notice that the proceedings are being filmed, so if you want to sit through the entire thing again, you can go to our website. And equally, if you missed out on copies of the slides or you would like to get some more copies, you will be able to find those on our website as well. On that basis, thank you very much for coming, and ask you to join me in thanking our two speakers.